If you turn back in your Bibles to the Gospel of John, chapter 15, page 1243 of the Church Bibles. And we're looking from verse 9 to verse 17. We're in the upper room discourse, but not necessarily in the upper room at the end of chapter 14, they've got up to go to Gethsemane. Jesus has little time left and he's got things he's got to say because there are things they've got to know. And he's just used this illustration of the vine. Jesus is the vine. The Father is the vine dresser, husbandman, farmer. And we are the branches. And the purpose of vine branches is to bring forth fruit. And we do that by staying in the vine. And the section we're looking at from verse 9, that picture is very much still in his mind. He doesn't go back to it expressly until verse 16, but he's really fleshing it out. You know, the vine is a picture. What does it look like in practice? And what he says, or what he's saying, is he's really interweaving different things, tying them together tightly. Things you might not necessarily think are connected are actually, he's saying, very closely connected in reality. He does that with people, and we're not particularly looking at that aspect, but he moves from father to son to individual Christian to other Christians. But he does it with aspects of life. And each route he goes down, if you like, brings us back to Christ and his love for us and what that means. I've divided it into three, and each of my three headings has three words in it to reflect these different themes being knitted together. And my first is love, obedience, joy. Love, obedience, joy. And here we're thinking particularly of verses 9 to 11. The call in the first 8 verses was to abide in Christ in verse 4. Christians have to stay close to Christ. And that call is repeated in verse 9 in the context of God's love. The Father loves, supremely loves the Son. The Son supremely loves his people. And so we are to continue in his love, or abide in his love. What does that mean? Abide or continue in my love? Love me back? Enjoy my love? Well, it means, verse 10, that we keep his commandments, that we obey. Equating love with obedience sounds odd, doesn't it? It sounds slightly old-fashioned, perhaps. We wouldn't necessarily put those two together, but how love is expressed, or how it should be expressed, depends on the relationship between you and the other person. Think of the different relationships in your life. Think of friendships, different levels of friendship. Think of family. Think of the different love you would have for a parent or a sibling or a spouse or a child. It all depends, doesn't it, on who you are, who they are, what the relationship is. And when it comes to us and Christ, the appropriate way to express love is to obey him. Because Jesus was and is human. He is approachable. He is God come to us. But Jesus is also the Lord of glory. And he's the Word of the Father. He is the creator and sustainer of all things. In any relationship between the rest of humanity, there is an element of equality, isn't there? But in us and Christ, there is an unavoidable inequality. He is the Lord, and we're not. We're sinners. And he has the right, intrinsic, natural, and earned, to expect our obedience. And also, the reality is that as you come to know him, what he does and what he commands is lovely. He is the altogether lovely one. And so the obedience he draws from us, it's not, well, you know, I suppose I better do what he says this time because he's the boss. It is a grateful, loving response. Can't separate love for Christ from obedience to Christ. It's folly to try. But then he takes us in the direction of joy, verse 11. He's told us to keep his commandments and abide in his love in order that we might know joy. And again, if you just stop and think about that, that's kind of odd, isn't it? You might see love producing joy, but obedience? Surely going my own way is a better route to happiness than obeying someone else. But no, Jesus said this that we might know that as Christians, our joy comes from going his way. Your joy will come if you're his, from going his way. It's not just cause and effect. It's not just, if I obey him, then I'll be happy. The problem with that is you're not going to obey him all the time, and so therefore you won't be joyful. It's a very uncertain, fluctuating ground for joy. You need a more solid base than that. If you try and obey him just to be happy, you will fail. It's inevitable. It's talking about more than cause and effect. It's talking about Christ working in his people. It is Christ giving his own joy. These things, verse 11, these things have I spoken unto you, that my joy might remain in you. It is Christ giving you his own joy, just as in the previous chapter he said he will give us his peace. 14 verse 27, peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you. And it's the same as his love, as we've seen in verse 9 of chapter 15. There's something mysterious about that, isn't it? It is Christ's own experience of joy shared with his people. It is a joy that is meant to remain. He's spoken these things that my joy might remain in you. This is not supposed to be a transitory experience. A moment in the heights before you get back to the drudgery of normal life. It is a bedrock. It is meant to be like a weed you cannot get rid of. It just keeps coming back up when life cuts it down. And he wants his people to have a fullness of joy. These things have I spoken unto you, that my joy might remain in you. I'm going to stop there. Time's short. Every word matters now. But he says, and that your joy might be full. God doesn't want you to have a little bit of joy, enough to get you through life. It's like, you know, it's like a bit of seasoning on your food, salt on your chips or whatever. He wants you to have as much as he had, the fullness of it, the persistence of it, a joy in all things, about all things, beyond the end of all things. He wants you to know that joy. And we get there by loving him and obeying him and then knowing him give us his joy. So love, obedience, joy. Secondly, obedience, love, friendship. We're looking at verses 12 to 14. Okay, you say, if I love Jesus, if I love Christ, if I love God, I've got to obey Christ. What does he tell me to do? He tells us in verse 12 to love one another as Christ has loved us. And again, it's odd, isn't it? Loves as a command. Is it in a feeling, a choice, a compulsion, madness? But it's not, you must love that person. It doesn't really work, does it, you might think. It's odder still who you've got to love, one another. It's not a general be nice to everyone. It's specific. It's you've got to love your fellow Christians. It doesn't mean to say you can't love non-Christians, but he's saying you've got to have a particular care for one another. You've got to look out for one another. You've got to pray for one another. You've got to do good to one another. And it's strange because amongst the other branches to the vine, there will be people who you have no natural affinity with. They are different characters. They just think a different way. They act a different way. Different temperaments, different outlooks, different interests. Now, in any medium-sized church, there'll be people there who you would never associate with if it wasn't for the fact you both went to the same church. There will be people in the same church who you would not naturally like. You would think mildly rude things about them, possibly. But you've still got to love one another. Jesus says, you're both mine. I've loved you both. You do have something in common. It's me. And I'm telling you, for my sake, love one another. Practically love and help one another. And he's the pattern and the reason for that. He loved you when you were unlovely, when you were lost, rebellious. He loves you now, if you're a Christian, with all your foibles and failures. Most of us in the Christian life have not advanced in loveliness as much as perhaps we might. And yet, Christ loves us. And so we ought to love those who he loved. And then it gets mildly terrifying in verse 13. How much am I supposed to love you lot? Cup of tea? Chat? Help with something if you need it? I don't know, a kidney if you need one, if I match? No, he says, the greatest love is that someone lays down their lives for their friends. I mean, the crucifixion's in view here, isn't it? He's speaking as if it had already happened. He speaks of choosing to lay down his life. It's alarming, isn't it, because of that standard. The probability is, you'll be glad to know, that you won't actually have to lay down your life for anyone else. But it gets it to the heart, isn't it, which is self-sacrifice. You have to be prepared to give up of your own time, resources, comfort, maybe in a small way, maybe in a large way, in order to help Christ's people. And it also tells us, doesn't it, that Christ's love for us is so much greater than our love will ever be for anybody. Because he did this. He's about to do it. His is more self-effacing, more willing, more powerful, more effective than any of our love can ever be. He had more to give, and he gave it all for you. For me, made himself of no reputation. We're not going to match up to that, aren't we? As we might. And we have to love one another as we can and as circumstances require us. And he says, he laid down his life for his friends. Christ's people are his friends. I'm going to build on that in a second in the next point, but it goes back to obedience, doesn't it? He roots our friendship in his actions and our response, not just the second. He was friendly and a friend to us when we were no such things to him. And we continue to be his friends if we obey. See what I mean about going round in circles? You think you've done with the concept and he comes back to it again. We'll see in a second one of the reasons why there's a benefit to that. But thirdly, friendship, knowledge, purpose. We're looking at verses 15 to 16. Friendship, knowledge, purpose. He's just referred to them as friends in verse 14. And then he builds on that in verse 15. You talk of obedience and it sounds like someone's a servant, doesn't it? Because they've got to do what they're being told to do. No, he barks, we jump. Gives a sense of distance. And as I said, there is a sense of distance between us and the Lord because he is greater than us. And yet, he calls us his friends. He says, you're not my servants. That's not to say the term servant isn't ever appropriate. He's saying you're so much more than that. You think of it, if you had servants, it'd be nice, wouldn't it? You could lay them off. Sorry, you've employed them for 2 years. You had your stint, off you go. There's a limit to that relationship. He says you're so much more than just somebody I get to push about or order about. You're my friends. And what marks out a friend? Don't know, you could think in your minds, can't you? How do I define friendship? But he actually says it's knowledge. Now, a servant has to obey. And they don't necessarily know the whys and the wherefores. It's sort of charge of the light brigade stuff, isn't it? There's not to reason why, there's but to do or die. Someone tells you to do something, you do it, and you don't think or question. That's how a servant has to act. A friend is somebody you confide in. You tell friends things about yourself you don't want the world to know. You reveal more of yourself. You let them see more behind the mask. And you can think about close friends and slightly further off friends. It's differentiated. Well, one way of differentiating between them is how much they know about you, how much that is current they know about you. And you do that because you trust them. You trust them to handle responsibly what you're going to say and to help you. And you trust them as you don't trust others. And you've tested that trust. I mean, how many times have you heard school children say that their best friend has, they've told something to them and then they've gone and told the playground? But a real friend, you tell them things, some of the secrets of the heart, and it goes no further. Well, Jesus says, you know I'm your friend because I've told you things. I've told you my secrets. And you might say to that, well, but there's so much I don't know. There's so much I'd like to know about God, about eternity, about why this is happening to me or that's happening to that person that I don't know. But you do know a lot, and what you know is key. It's central. Saving. Now, Paul makes this point, doesn't he? There's that verse that gets quoted. Eye is not seen, nor ear heard, neither is it entered into the heart of the man the things that God has prepared for those that love him. So this mystery of the life to come. And then he says, but God has revealed them to us by his Spirit. God has told us some of his secrets. And you might say, well, why is he? How has he just told Christians? I mean, anybody can pick this up and read it. Surely everyone then knows, and it's nothing special for us. But it's not just talking, is it, about what we understand? It's talking about what we experience, what we believe, what we hold to, what we embrace. It's talking about the work of the Spirit in our hearts, teaching us, really teaching us his truth and revealing himself. It's talking about his choice of us in verse 16 and God ordaining us. And I suppose that's one thing he says that we learn it. Our friendship with Jesus is his work and his choice, not ours. There's got to be a humility in this friendship, isn't there? There's got to be a recognition of God's. It could be a very boastful thing, then. God is my friend. It can make you quite conceited, couldn't it? But we can't say God is my friend as if we deserved credit. God has come and been a friend to me, a real friend, a friend to you. He's chosen to be friends with us. All the people he could have chosen, he chose us lot. But friendship has a purpose. This friendship has a purpose that he talks about in verse 16. Things are meant to be done. What's meant to happen? Verse 16, we're meant to go and bring forth fruit. We're back finally to the vine, aren't we? Expressly to the vine anyway, in the first bit of this passage. God makes himself your friend in order that we might live lives that are fruitful and that glorify God. That we conform to Christ and show evidence of his work in us. And that fruit, where you can find it if you look in the New Testament, love, joy, peace, long-suffering, and so forth. Not obvious worldly things, but things that please God. He wants us to bring forth fruit that abides or remains, that word again. You've not chosen me, verse 16, but I have chosen you and ordained you that you should go and bring forth fruit and that your fruit should remain. He's not thinking of fruit that is brief or ephemeral, which you might think when you hear love, joy, peace, and so on. He's talking about things that last beyond the grave, that will endure beyond the end of all things. Says, doesn't it, in Revelation, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord, that they may rest from their labours and their works do follow them. He wants fruit that will follow you and follow me. And I mean, it goes without saying, doesn't it? You can have as much worldly success as you want. And if you've worked hard for it, then well done. You can honour God in that, but that's not going to endure. And he wants us to be fruitful in order that we might ask him for things. Whatsoever you shall ask of the Father in my name, he may give it to you. Do you see? I think this... You take that on its own and you think, well, that's great. I will write a shopping list and I will ask and he'll give them to me. But this is the benefit of wrapping all these things together. You have a context for that right to ask. You have a context for that power to ask. In one sense, it's like putting an advert in the paper or whatever the 21st century equivalent of that is. I know that's things have changed. Saying... here's my details, whatever you want, I will give it to you. Sending it out to the world at large and getting random requests from anybody. That is how it appears if you take it out of context. But if you put it in context, it's like going to a friend and saying, I'm here, I will help you, ask what you want, and if I can do it, I will. It's very different, isn't it? Helps you understand those words. And yet it's meant to make our faith bold, isn't it? Do we really think Jesus is our friend? Do we really think he loves us? Let's ask him for things. He wants to be asked. He expects to be asked. It is an exercise of faith to take these words in context and believe them. He wants to show that he's our friend, if you like, by answering prayer. We close by verse 17, which is a repetition of this command to love one another. And We're back where we started, aren't we? We started with love. We're back with love again. It feels a bit like, I don't know if you ever had it, where you've gone a certain route lots of times and there's a road you've seen and you've wondered, oh, I wonder what's down there. I've never been down there because I've not had a reason to. So one day you try it and then suddenly you go down that road and you find it gets you to a place you know. Oh, right, it's that there. It gets me back to somewhere that's familiar. And so it is with this. You go off on seemingly strange tangents and that you end back at a place that is familiar. And that familiar place is Christ and his sacrificial, bleeding love for you and the call to abide in him, and he will abide in us. May God then help us to do that. It's such simple words, isn't it? Abide in me and I in you. May God help us to do that and then understand how all these other things come in, fill our lives, and that we may know the practical, felt friendship of Christ for us.